In the language of the period of Sfiras HaOmer is a kind of Chol HaMoed between the Yom Tov of Pesach and the Yom Tov of Shavuos, during which we are hoping, aspiring every day of Sfiras HaOmer to improve, to enhance some aspect, some element of our Avodas Hashem, in the hopes of being worthy of being mekabel the Torah, of receiving the Torah. And in thinking about the trajectory and nature of that Avoda, I think it's helpful, instructive, to reflect on a Maisa, on a story that is told by Rabbi Nachman from Breslov. And it's not an original story, as some of his stories are. It's an adaptation of a story that was known well before him, whether it's of Jewish origin or secular origin, I couldn't tell you. But it was a story that was well known, that he changed the ending. He changed the punchline. And I believe he did so deliberately. You know, there's a whole genre of young adult literature known as choose your own adventure, where it's like a mystery and there's multiple endings that the reader can choose from. And obviously the author has to be skilled, because you have to leave clues and hints and breadcrumbs that could lead you in multiple directions. And based on whatever ending you choose, you have a different perspective on the story. I'll see, oh, this one was the villain. Oh, this one was the thief. And the whole story seems somewhat different. So similarly, I believe Rabbi Nachman changed the end of the story on purpose in order to change the message that the story conveys. Anyway, the story goes as follows. There is a king, every good Chassidish story has a king, and there's a king who purchases a palace which has a grand ballroom that he wants to decorate in the style of grand palaces. Think of Versailles or maybe the mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, if you've been there from the Gilded Age. A very elaborate room. But the room is too big for one artisan to undertake, so he splits the job into two. He gives one artisan on the left the job of decorating the left side of the room, one artisan that he chooses on the right to decorate the right side of the room, and he gives them 6 months to do so. And he tells them, I'm going to return in 6 months and I'll pay you for the work that you've done after I survey it. The artisan on the left takes the job very seriously. And he starts thinking, you know, what would the king want me to paint? And what would, you know, intrigue him, what would make him happy, and maybe he could up his game a little bit in terms of his skills. So he goes back, he hits the books, and then he really works very hard on painting his side of the room. The other guy disappears. You don't see him from the beginning of this month, right? 5.5 months later, haven't seen hide nor hair from this guy. 2 days before this period of 6 months are up, he shows up, and he sees what the guy did on the left. It's quite impressive. His side is a blank canvas, so to speak. So he puts up a curtain down the middle of the room. You know, artists are sometimes very protective of their privacy. They're paranoid, a little petulant. So he puts up a curtain down the side of the room. No one should see what he's doing. And he's very busy behind the curtain on the right side for 2 days. Then the king shows up, and the king sees what the artist on the left did. And what he did was unbelievable. He painted murals, frescoes on the ceiling, landscapes from his youth that the king was used to when he was growing up, with portraits of his bubbies, of his zaydas, of the entire family tree. The ceiling was biblical scenes that the king was fond of. The king was overwhelmed. You know, breathtaking. A, the skill, how much effort he put into thinking about what the king would want to see. He was overwhelmed. Overwhelmed. So he asks the artist on the right, "Nope, let me see, what did you do?" So the artist on the right pulls down the cloth, the curtain, and what he sees is that on the right, he paneled the whole right side of the room in mirrors. In mirrors. So it reflected everything that was on the left side. But in doing so, since the guy on the left did so much work, it gave it tremendous depth. And it was an entirely different experience. And instead of the king thinking about the landscapes from the past, or, you know, having nostalgia from sitting with his grandfather, he now felt like he was transported back in history, like he was sitting and schmoozing with his Zayda, like he was in the tent of Avram Avinu itself with the biblical images on the ceiling. It gave it an entirely different experience. So the way that the story goes traditionally, you know, before Rabbi Nachman, was that the king took 2 bags of coins. He came and he put them down on the left side next to the artist who spent a lot of time and investment in painting his side of the room. And he places them on the floor and he says to the artist, "This is your payment for all of your hard work." And then he points to the reflection of those two bags in the right side of the room, because the right side of the room is paneled with mirrors. So he sees the reflection of the bags on the other side, and he says to the artist on the right, the reflection of those two bags is your payment. You worked in mirrors, you got paid in mirrors. Worked in monopoly money, got paid in monopoly money. It's just a fantastic punchline, right? It's very satisfying, it's very witty, it comes to teach the time, you know, old lesson of Atareach Berev Shabbos, Yechav Shabbos, of Lefum Tzara Agra, the value of hard work, and that there's no shortcuts. It's a very satisfying story. Rabbi Nachman changed the story. And in his version, the king takes two bags of coins. One he gives to the artist on the left for his hard work, and the same, you know, value, the same schera, the same wage he pays to the artist on the right. He rewards them equally, and that's where the story ends. It seems very, very unsatisfying. Why did Rabbi Nachman reward the guy who paneled the side of mirrors? And I believe he's coming to teach us a profound lesson about growth in Avodas Hashem. But let's just take a step back. We know that there's a mitzvah on every yontif to be besimcha. V'samachta b'chagecha, v'yisa'ach sameach. Which is an emotional experience, to be besimcha in our Avodas Hashem. But our emotions are not light switches, even though sometimes we would like them to be. A person, let's say, is in a bad mood. He's frustrated. He's disappointed. You know, let's say with the normal things of life, not something that's beyond. How do you expect me to turn a light switch today? All of a sudden, yesterday I was upset. I wasn't happy. Today, all of a sudden, now I'm happy. How can we have such a mitzvah to be besimcha? So Chazal tell us, how do we fulfill this mitzvah? We fulfill the mitzvah by doing actions that engender simcha. Eating meat and drinking wine, buying clothing, buying games, each demographic, kafi mashahu, whatever brings a person simcha, those actions are the way that the mitzvah is practiced. Meaning by acting simcha, besimcha, acting happy, that inspires, that triggers the internal emotion of being happy. Let's say a person is having a bad day, regular run-of-the-mill kind of stuff, and he's just feeling down. If he starts smiling, many people will tell you, just start smiling, you will feel happier. You'll feel happier. Oh yeah, the chagiga, yeshiva chagiga, hakafas and simchas Torah. Inevitably, at one of these events, there's always people standing on the side, not because they feel marginalized, but because they're just not in the mood that day to be involved in a rakida, and there's usually someone, you know, a little bit levitic that pulls them in. Once they start dancing, once you start going around, a few minutes later, the guy could be in the middle, you know, dancing up a storm. I have this, parents have had this experience on Chol HaMoed. When you go on a Chol HaMoed trip, you bring your kids, you spend so much time planning these things, you know, inevitably there's one kid who's not into the trip, you know, didn't want to go to a trampoline park that day, right? But what happens, I'm standing on the side soaking. You take the kid, you put him on the trampoline. After jumping on the trampoline a little bit, you know, who doesn't like jumping on a trampoline? All of a sudden, the kid is into it. Why? Because sometimes by doing those external actions, that arouses within us the internal emotions. In fact, perhaps that's what the pasuk means in Parashat Yisra'eh. V'samachta b'chagecha, v'hayisa'ach sameach. One is a command, the other, perhaps a havtacha. If you act happy, v'hayisa'ach sameach, you will become happy. So the way the mitzvah of simcha is practiced is that by doing sometimes external actions that arouses, that inspires within us the internal emotions. In the language of the Sefer HaChinuch, which is familiar, acharei ha-pu'ulois nimshachim ha-lavavois. Sometimes it's the external actions that trigger within us the internal emotions. You know, in Parashas Emor, the Torah tells us about the mitzvahs that apply on Sukkot. Have a mitzvah of sukkah, a mitzvah of lulav, of dal and minim. So in the order in which they appear in Parshas Emor, it's first the lulav, and then the sukkah. In Chazal, in the Gemara Masechta the sukkah, the first two prakim deal with yeshiva b'sukkah, the third parak deals with lulav, which is the opposite of the way that it appears in Chumash. Haloi davar hu, Chazal switched it. Why did Chazal switch it? Why did they switch the order? So Stuchina Rebbe suggests that perhaps they switch the order again on purpose to teach us a lesson about Avodas Hashem. The lulav represents the internal emotions of performing the mitzvah. The Mori Naim writes, lulav is a combination of two words, loy lev. I take my heart and I give it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what we do with the Nanuim. In all six directions, each time coming back to our heart, we're saying in all six directions, taking our lev and expressing it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, handing it over to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But it represents the internal emotions. The sukkah is the external actions that we do. It's beyond us. It's something that a lot of people can see, and it's not connected necessarily to our body. It's something that's beyond us. represents the external activity of doing the mitzvah. The Torah first places the lulav and then the sukkah. Why? Because what should happen is that a person should have an internal emotion, a connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam to want to do mitzvahs, and that should spill over, that should express itself in the external action. Chazal switched it. Deliberately. Because even though that makes a lot of sense, that's not the way people operate. The way people operate is sometimes you have to have that external stimulus that then triggers the internal emotions. And therefore, Chazal put sukkah before the lulav. Stuchina Rebbe suggests that perhaps this is a similar debate that's going on between Moshe and Bitzal with regards to the construction of the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu argues that first we have to build a kelim that went inside of the Mishkan, the Yaron, Shulchan, the Mizbeach, Menorah, and then the edifice of the Mishkan itself. And Bitzal argues with Moshe Rabbeinu. And he says, nobody does that. You don't buy furniture and then find an apartment that fits your furniture. First you buy an apartment, or first you rent an apartment, and then you furnish the apartment with furniture that fits inside of the apartment. And anyway, if you bought furniture before the apartment, where would you put the furniture in the interim? So Bitzal argues, it makes no sense to do it that way. That's not the way people do things. First, you build the Mishkan, first you buy the apartment, and then you furnish it with the furniture, and then you build the cave. What are they arguing about? Home decoration? So Stuchina Rebbe again explains they're arguing about a fundamental in Avodas Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu was arguing to Bitzal that the way things should progress is first there should be the kelim inside. That's the internal emotion of doing the mitzvahs, of wanting to connect to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And then that should spill over into the externals of the mitzvah, which is represented by the edifice of the Mishkan. So first the kelim, first what goes inside, and then the edifice, what comes outside. And Bitzal said, it makes a lot of sense to do it that way, but nobody does it like that. Nobody does it like that. First you buy the apartment, then you buy the furniture. First, sometimes you need the external action, and it's through that external action that triggers the internal emotion. The Torah in Parshas Tetzaveh tells us all about the Big Day Kahuna in great detail. There's one detail about the Big Day Kahuna that is not mentioned in Parshas Tetzaveh. It's saved till later on in Parshas Tzav. And that is, the Torah tells us in Parshas Tzav, V'lovash ha-kohen midoy vad. That, by the way, the Big Day Kahuna we talked about at length, we elaborated on in Parshas Tzav, have to fit the kohen. If he's a medium, it's got to be a medium. It can't be extra large. Okay, the Big Day Kahuna have to fit the kohen. Why did the Torah not tell us that in Parshas Tetzav, the Ibn Ezra, in Parshas Tetzav, already asked the question, why is this detail left all the way till Parshas Tetzav? So it seems to me that perhaps it's because when the Kohen was first initiated into the Kahuna, he felt like he was wearing his father's clothing. He felt like he was a medium and the clothing were an extra large. They didn't fit him. Later on, in Parshas Tetzav, the Torah says, by the way, at some point you got to fill out those garments that you're wearing, but that happened in Memela by wearing the garments that were too big for him, It didn't match his internals. Ultimately, that's how he grew to fill out those garments. Acharei ha-pu'ulois, nimshachem ha-lavavois. We're uncomfortable with this viscerally. Why? Because to us, it seems phony. Your externals don't match your internals. You're fake. A fraud. It's disingenuous. It's hypocritical. It's insulting. Who are you trying to fool? You're a phony. You're a fake. And there's a part of that impulse that's good, and that's right. The Gemara tells us in Masechtas Yuma that the construction of the Aron. The Aron was a wooden core with a gold plate on the inside and on the outside to teach us. Aron represents the Talmud Chacham, that every Talmud Chacham, every Oved Hashem should attempt to be Teichel Kabari. His inside should reflect his outsides. They should be in sync. They should be consistent. It shouldn't be externally one way and internally something else. No one wants to be Esav. Right, who was asking Yitzchak about how to take Truma and Maisa from salt while he was engaging in Ritzicha, Gidei Arayis, and Avodah Zarah in private. No one wants to be the Chazir who sticks out his split hooves, but then does not chew its cud. And because of that, we're uncomfortable with this kind of advice of allowing the externals to outpace the internals. And that's good. That's good. We want to be Teichel Kabaro. And I agree that if a person is using external from virtue signaling to distract or to supplant true Avodas Hashem, that's a problem. That's a problem. That's wrong. He's fooling himself and he's fooling others. That's wrong. He is a fraud. He is a fake. He is a phony. But sometimes it's the Yetzirah. Sometimes it's the Yetzirah talking. It's the Yetzirah that's telling us. A guy, let's say, comes to Davin and for a week he doesn't have kavana. Then, punked in the middle of one brach of Shemana Esrei, he starts having kavana. He starts shuckling, and the Yetzer Hara says to him, "You phony! What? Where were you? Shloicha brachas rishonis. Where were you? Where were you Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Erev Shabbos, in the middle of Mincha Erev Shabbos?" He wakes up in the middle. That's the Yetzer Hara talking. Or a person, let's say, comes late to Seder, you know, whatever. And then one day he wakes up early, gets in his Soirus, Min HaShamayim, and he comes on time. And then either his Chaverim next to him or the Yetzer Hara says to him, "Oh, look who's on time today," you know. That's the Yetzer Hara talking. That's the Yetzer Hara talking. It's the Yetzer Hara who tells us, "You're a phony, you're a fake, stop trying to grow." That's the Yetzer Hara. It's okay to have sometimes the externals outpace the internals. You know, there's a famous Rosh HaTevis. One of the names that we refer to the Yetzer Hara, actually a Malach that's Mamuna on Esav, they're spelled Samach Mem Aleph Lamed. Refer to the Yetzer Hara as the Samach Mem. So in the Jikavar, in the Imre Noyam, he writes Samach Mem Aleph Lamed is a Rosh Teva, Siyam Mesefta Ein Lasos. Shouldn't make a Siyam. The Yetzer Hara loves Brachas Dab Beis. He's thrilled. Stop Brachas Dab Beis, Gittin Dab Beis. He'll get you Gimel, Dalet, Hey. He'll get you somewhere along the way. If not, right, Yetzias HaShavas, then he'll leave, comes Yetzias HaShavas, he'll leave at Mesef HaShavas. Whatever, he gets you later. The Yetzer Hara has no problem waiting. He plays the long game. So good, Dapez, feel very good about yourself. Pat yourself on the back. We'll get you later on. See him Mesef HaShavas. But I think that's the way it's traditionally understood. I think the Rosh HaTevis is coming to teach us something else. What the Yetzer Hara says to us is, even if you finish the Mesefta, you are not Kedai to make a Siyam. What? You remember Daf Beis? You remember Daf Gimel? Well, what about that day that you came late and you missed this or you missed that? You didn't do Tosfos. Oh, did you even do every Rashi? So the Yetzer Hara says to us, you finish a Mesefta, but see a Mesefta in Lasos. You're not entitled to make a Mesefta because you're a phony, you're a fake. It won't be true to who you are. You're going to make people think you have a Kinyan on this Mesefta. You have no Kinyan. You have no, yeah. You're just starting. Go back to Daf Beis again and get started again. See a Mesefta in Lasos. And that's why people give up in the middle, because they miss one day and they say, "Oh, I don't want to come back tomorrow. I'll think of myself as a fake or a phony, so I'm not going to come." That's exactly why people give up. But that's the Yetzer Hara talking. That's the Yetzer Hara talking. Why? Because it's specifically through that, when the externals outpace the internals, it's through that dynamic that growth actually occurs. It's in that space. Back to the story of Nachman. Nachman changed the end of the story. The story was the two artisans, one worked very hard, the other made a room full of mirrors. He rewarded both artisans exactly the same. Why? Why do you reward a guy just for building mirrors? So I believe what he was coming to teach us is, many of his stories are autobiographical, is that sometimes he felt that each artisan represented a part of himself. Sometimes he felt like he was the artisan who worked his whole life to be a tzaddik that would inspire others and carry on the Messiah of the Baal Shem Tov. But sometimes he felt like the artisan that all he was a show of mirrors. That he was a reflection, a shell of himself. And he wasn't really in it. His heart, his mind wasn't engaged. He felt like he was just reflecting what was yesterday. And he rewards them both the same, because you need to be able to handle being both sometimes in order to grow in Avodas Hashem. There's a well-known story with the Satmar Rebbe. They imitate Rebbes and Rebbeim on Purim. It seems it's acceptable. So in some places they ask Mechila beforehand. So they came to Satmar Rebbe, one of the Bar Chanim, asked Satmar Rebbe, "Do you mind if I imitate you on Purim davening?" Satmar Rebbe said, "Fine." So they started imitating him. In the middle, the Satmar Rebbe started crying. So the Chassid, the Badkin, rushed up to the Satmar Rebbe. He said, "I didn't mean to insult you. Why are you crying?" He said, No, what you did is fine. What you did is perfect. In fact, it's such a perfect imitation of me. I wonder, maybe sometimes I'm imitating myself in davening, since I'm so easy to imitate." And it's a very powerful message about how sometimes we just go through the motions and our heart and our mind should be in it. But the Musar HaSkel is not to come to davening because your heart and mind isn't in it. What the Musar HaSkel is that even if your mind and your heart isn't in it today, come. And even if you're not engaged and your mind is distracted, you still have to be there, because sometimes, don't let the Yetzer tell you you're fake, you're phony or something like that, or even if you miss this or that, don't be discouraged from showing up later on. That's the Yetzer Hara talking, because we have to be able to embrace both. Yes, we want everything to be in sync. We want the Teichei Kabara. But even if we fall short of that, we have to understand that that's also part of Avodas Hashem. The Sefer Achinuch, in formulating that famous comment of Acharei HaPa'ulos Nimshach HaMalavavos, is responding to a question that he raised. Why is it that we have so many mitzvahs that are zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim? We have the daily mitzvah twice a day to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, Tzipi Yetzias Mitzrayim, the night of the Seder, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, all the mitzvahs connected with Pesach. But more than that, we have reminders all year. Tzitzis, Tefillin, Shabbos, Oinah, where you wouldn't expect it. There's Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why do we need so many reminders of Yetzias Mitzrayim? So the Sefer HaChinuch explains, because it's such an important inyan that the Torah wants us to internalize, to re-experience, to feel connected to. So the Torah gives us many reminders because Acharei HaPu'ulos Nimshachim HaLevavos. Why is this foundational principle in all of Avodas Hashem formulated specifically with regards to Pesach? Why is it on Pesach in particular? See, Ari HaKadosh explains in the Shaar HaKavonos that it's because when Klal Yisrael was leaving Mitzrayim, we were on, as he explains, the Mem Tesh Shari Tumah. V'lo yachol lehis mameya, we couldn't wait any longer. We were on the edge of oblivion. We were at the lowest madrega. What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? Did he say, okay, let's start a process of growing step by step? No. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us al kanfei nesharim, and we had the greatest revelation, you know, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, greater than Yechezkel, Hanavi, of everyone pointing and saying, Zeh Keli V'anveil. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us from the depths, and he gave us madregas that we did not deserve. That's why in the night of the Seder, we're busy stealing the matzah. Explains the Kushner, Magid and Avodas Yisrael, because we're stealing madregas that don't belong to us. We didn't earn it. Our externals are outpacing our internals. That's exactly what happens on Pesach. That's why the second day of Pesach, the day when we bring the Karban HaOmer, is referred to as the Yom HaNef, the day of the waving, because we wave the Karban HaOmer. The Ari HaKadosh writes, it's the Yom HaNefila. It's the day we come back to earth. Like a person who's at the top of a roller coaster, that's the night of the Seder, an explosion of revelation of Ruchnius, and then we plummet. We start at the bottom of the, you know, take the chute all the way down, and now we have to start climbing the ladder. And what is the Avoida of the Emeya Sphira? The Avoida of Sphira HaOmer is to attempt to bring in sync our external madrigas that HaKadosh Baruch Hu artificially gave us, the Yom Tov of Pesach, and bring them in sync with our internal emotions. Day by day, working to earn those madrigas that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us for free on Pesach. But what I think it teaches us even more than that is that what is the springboard, what propels us to this series of growth is being able to handle that dissonance. Being able to handle that there's a distinction, a disparity between our external actions and our internal emotions. The way that we are acting and the way that we actually are inside, which is how Pesach begins. It's that gap, it's that space that inspires us to grow. The difference between the people who we want to be and the people who we actually are now. You know, the year begins with Pesach, it concludes, the calendaric year, right? It concludes with Adar, concludes with Purim. Now, Chazal tells us that there's a connection between Purim and Pesach, such that if there's a Ivri Yor, if there's a leap year, Sigmar actually entertains celebrating Purim in either Adar, Adar Rishon or Adar Sheni. We celebrate Purim, the Gemara prefers to celebrate another Sheni, in order to be Mismach Gula L'Gula, to connect the Gula of Purim together with the Gula of Pesach. What does wearing masks on Purim have to do with eating matzah on Pesach? Why is the runway for Pesach Purim? Moreover, Purim is an anomaly amongst all the Yomim Tovim. Every other Yom Tov is celebrated universally on the same date. So we keep a second day, and so there's only one, but we start on the same day. Rosh Hashanah starts on Aleph Tishrei for everyone. Sukkot is on the 15th. Yom Kippur is on the 10th. So Hanukkah is on the 25th, and so on and so forth. The only Yom Tov that starts different at different times for different people is Purim. The people inside of the walled cities was the 15th. The people outside the walled cities was the 14th. And we know that there's a historical reason for this. As the Megillah tells us, the people inside of Shushan continued to fight for an extra day, and they rested a day later than the people outside. But it's interesting. Haloi Davrahu, again, two different days. Within the same, we couldn't get in sync over here. Why this difference? And again, I think that this is coming to teach us something critical about the end of the year, which lays the foundation for the beginning of the year. The walled cities represents the internal emotions that are present in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those outside the walled cities represents the external action. That's exactly why a Metzora in this week's Parsha is exiled. He's evicted from the walled cities because he took an external action, a failing, a fault that he saw in somebody else, and he defined him entirely by that external judgment that he made of him. Disregarding, you know, all of the internal good, the inherent kedusha that's present inside of every Jew. And because of that, we evict him from the walled city because he ignored the panemius and we make him live in the world of chitzonius. But what Purim comes to teach us is that even at the end of the year, if these two parts of our lives are not in sync, if the Pnimius is outpacing, or is on a different page than the Chitzonius, or the Chitzonius is outpacing the Pnimius, it's okay. It's okay. We're attempting during Sefiras HaOmer to bring everything in sync, to bring everything in line. However, even if we fail in that, and even if we get all the way to the end of the year, where the Pnimius is different from the Chitzonius, the external actions are not the same as the internal emotions, that's okay. And in fact, it is that disparity, it's that dissonance, that enables us to grow throughout the period of Sefiras HaOmer. So, Mirza Hashem, we should never be intimidated from starting something new. Don't let the Yetzer Hara tell us we're a fake, we're a phony. We should undertake in every day of Sefiras HaOmer to attempt to bring our Pnimius in line with our Chitzonius. But even, if there is somewhat of a distance, to understand that it's specifically through that gap, the difference between the people who we want to be and the people who we are, that will ultimately enable us to grow day after day and come closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam.